The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Despite the federal government's recent decision to uphold marijuana's classification as a Schedule I substance, most indicators point to pot's days of prohibition coming to an end. 26 states now permit the use of medical marijuana, but of those, only 15 sanction home cultivation. Legislation has become increasingly restrictive towards home growers. Reporter Joel Warner found that the squeeze on growers limits access for people requiring medical marijuana treatment. Joel is a contributing writer for Vice's online magazine Motherboard. And Joel, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
So one of the people that you spoke to, Marissa Kaiser, tell us a little bit about her and how her story plays into this tension around small growers of medical marijuana.
So Marissa Kaiser story is similar to many of these really heartbreaking stories we're having here in Colorado. Her son was born with a very serious disease. He's kind of been ravaged by seizures since 3 days after he was born. With the idea that cannabis oil might help him, Marissa moved from South Carolina to Colorado several years ago, and she has found success with these cannabis oils. However, it can get quite expensive. She was looking to have to spend $2,000 a month in marijuana at local marijuana dispensaries, so she started growing her own. Her doctor's reference said she was allowed to grow up to 72 plants, but now the city she lives in, Colorado Springs, is saying that she could go to jail for growing this marijuana in her basement that she can go down the street and purchase from a local marijuana dispensary.
But Colorado is a state where medical marijuana is legal. Dispensaries are legal. So is this a city-to-city ordinance about cultivating your own, or state-by-state, what?
It's a bit of both. So, for example, in Colorado, which is rightly seen as one of the most liberal places these days for cannabis laws, we're seeing more and more communities saying, okay, we will allow dispensaries or recreational pot shops, but we're not going to allow home cultivation, or we're going to limit home cultivation. You know, the concern is, residential neighborhood, you shouldn't have these sort of grows, exposure, that sort of thing. But we're also seeing more and more states, especially along the East Coast, that are passing new statewide medical marijuana laws that are not allowing home cultivation at all.
Here in New Hampshire as well. Is medical marijuana there covered by insurance?
No, it's not.
So what is the reason for these restrictions on home growing? You mentioned it's in a neighborhood, but law enforcement seems to be coming down a little more precisely.
Yes. So I think the main reason is that law enforcement says, look, it's really difficult for us. Terms such as home grows and caregivers, which are kind of amorphous terms, we are seeing increases in these like black market kind of grow operations, including here in Colorado. And when law enforcement shows up at these places, it's hard for them to know whether they're home grows or black market operations. Now, they don't have the data yet to back this up, but since more and more of these new medical marijuana laws aren't being passed by votes of the people, but by legislatures, I believe that lawmakers are responding to these concerns and saying, fine, we're going to allow dispensaries or limited use of some of these cannabis oils, but we're not going to allow home grows.
Now, a couple of the sources you spoke to suggest that there is another reason behind this, since law enforcement doesn't have data to back up the idea of black market activity, which is pretty cynical, that it benefits the dispensaries, leading to these fears of, you know, the Walmarts of weed are going to get ground here, or the rise of big marijuana. Is there anything to back that up?
It does sound cynical, but then you look at a state like Nevada, which is voting to legalize recreational marijuana this year. If it does pass, they will have a rule as part of it that says that you will not be able to grow your own recreational marijuana if you live within 25 miles of a recreational marijuana shop. And so people look at that and say, well, isn't that completely just a concession to these new businesses that are trying to kind of get up and running? So there's concern about that. Now, I think you have to look at a potential analogy. And you go to the folks who have long advocated for home brewing. And it took them decades. And they say, well, you know what? We never saw Budweiser. We never saw Coors trying to stop home brewing. If you look at that comparison, there might not be that much incentive for these big industries to fight kind of a do-it-yourself marijuana.
Mm-hmm. Could small-scale home growers actually meet the need of a larger market, or are they just specifically growing for themselves?
So in a place like Colorado, you are seeing patients and caregivers allowed to grow up to...
I think it's 12 plants?
Yeah, 12 or more. You're seeing folks up to 50, 70, 99 plants. And that can cover a good amount of patients. However, when you look at the large-scale grows that are popping up in Colorado and elsewhere, where you're seeing, you know, hundreds upon hundreds of plants, these giant greenhouses or grow operations or these acres of fields, this will be a very small part.
Well, so some of your sources, you know, academics, others, people who do statistics on crime, do suggest that law enforcement has the ear of legislators. But it is, you know, this is a brave new world for legislators. A lot of them have this idea of marijuana as a dangerous drug. Do you think that the small growing community has made its case well enough with the legislative bodies who are making these kind of rules?
No, I don't think so, in that we're seeing more and more of these new laws restricting home grows. However, these patients have a really powerful tool, and that is these stories, you know, these stories of these parents and suffering kids and veterans struggling with PTSD and cancer survivors. I think as they get their stories out there and say, look, all we're saying is let us grow six plants. It's going to be locked up. It's going to be in our basement. It's no different than someone kind of growing tomatoes in their backyard. It's no different than the marijuana that I can go buy down the street for 10 times the price than it would cost me to grow it myself. So I think these stories have been used as leverage in these political discussions. I think they will continue to be used in this way.
Well, Joel, thank you for speaking with us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
Joel Warner, he's a Denver-based writer and a contributor to Vice's online magazine, Motherboard. You can find a link to his article, Marijuana Legalization is Leaving Home Growers Without a Pot to Grow In. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Machine gun executions, human incinerations, blown up buildings. Suicide Squad has all the makings of a summer blockbuster.
Don't forget, we're the bad guys.
Are you sweet talking me? All of that chit chat's gonna get you hurt.
And it's rated PG-13. On the indier side of things, Don't Think Twice is a dramedy about a freewheeling improv troupe presented with the possibility of real fame on national TV.
I like my life how it is right now.
You can't do improv forever, okay? It ends.
That film got an R rating from the MPAA, or Motion Picture Association of America, for featuring adult language and drug use. It is a standard that some critics find baffling. Katie Kilkenny is associate editor who writes about culture for Pacific Standard, and she put together a brief history of increasing violence in PG-13 films. Katie, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, Virginia. Thanks for having me.
Director Mike Birbiglia of Don't Think Twice pointed out what he considers hypocrisy in those ratings. What did he say?
Right. So 2 weeks ago, Mike Birbiglia wrote a tweet where he questioned why Suicide Squad, which is rated PG-13, has machine gun killings and bombings and got that relatively lax rating, whereas his film, which is sort of a heartfelt dramedy, got an R because, in his words, adults smoke pot. And then he wrote confusing. It's definitely something that others have found confusing before as well. And so this is sort of an interesting encapsulation of this moment when the film ratings board is more comfortable with allowing a lower threshold for children to see sort of explicit and graphic violence rather than, you know, some language and some legal drug use in mm-hmm. some states.
I know that X-Men Apocalypse, also out this summer, features decapitations and slit throats, also rated PG-13. So what is the MPAA standard on violence for PG-13 movies?
Right. So the MPAA's official language on violence in PG-13 movies is that there may be violence, but it should generally not be realistic and extreme or persistent violence. And this sort of seems to be unevenly applied to movies. One study that I came across noted that frequency of violence in movies is the same across all ratings when the movie is rated for violence. And individual examples of movies that feature sort of realistic and extreme and persistent violence abound. I'm sure sort of listeners are familiar with The Dark Knight or Taken or Hancock, all of which were rated PG-13 in this country. Whereas, you know, other countries might find the violence in those movies to be a little less appropriate for children who are younger.
You cited a couple of different studies on violent content in high-grossing PG-13 films. Is there a correlation between higher-grossing films and violence?
There is indeed. According to one 2004 study I found, there's a correlation between the mention of violence in the ratings description and higher revenues for films. Meanwhile, other studies have found that sex actually doesn't sell, so nudity and sexual content is associated with reduced revenues for films. And if you look at the highest grossing films of all time, you know, the top five ranging from Avatar to The Avengers, all have been rated PG-13. So it really is a moneymaker rating for the film industry.
How about the things that the MPAA does find objectionable in R-rated films? Sex, alcohol, tobacco use, drug use. Have those also increased over that time period?
No. So this is what's really interesting. Each decade since the introduction of the PG-13 rating, PG-13 rated movies have escalated in violence, according to one 2011 study. And yet no similar quote unquote ratings creep was found for other areas of adult content. So that would be sort of nudity, language, and sexual content. And in the meantime, you know, as the level of violence has increased, tobacco and alcohol use has decreased across all rating categories, according to a 2010 study. This is really interesting because the MPAA is currently facing a legal complaint that wants to ban smoking imagery from ratings PG-13 and under, which seems sort of a bit like a red herring when you consider that violence has been increasing while tobacco and alcohol use has been decreasing.
But you also think about, you know, parents. Their kids would be more likely probably to have casual sex or to pick up cigarettes, you know, like they do in the movies, than these radical actions, you know, blowing up a building. I mean, are they parents pushing against adult content over violence?
Right, exactly. So the MPAA's Film Ratings Board, CARA, which is the Classification and Ratings Administration, is composed entirely of parents. And they do purport to speak for other parents, which they execute by conducting yearly surveys of what parents are concerned about in films such as PG-13 rated films, and also by conducting focus groups. And surveys have found that the MPAA's ratings and their double standard on violence versus sex has been in line with what parents are actually concerned about. So a 2007 survey of parents' feelings on ratings found that the majority of them are more concerned about kids seeing sexual imagery and then deciding to engage in sexual activities before they're ready than kids seeing violent imagery and becoming more aggressive in real life. The PG-13 rating really is an interesting reflection of the concerns that American parents actually have for their children. At once, it's a very violent rating, and it's also very prudish.
But has that not changed at all when concern over violent video games, that was raised again after the Sandy Hook shootings, and of course, the mass shooting at a theater in Aurora, Colorado, showing The Dark Knight? So parents and activists are not linking violence in movies to that kind of violence?
Well, there has been more attention paid to the effect of violent imagery since those incidents that you mentioned. Following the 2012 shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary and the Boston Marathon bombings, Vice President Joe Biden actually met with the MPAA to discuss gun violence in America. Following that meeting, the MPAA introduced an initiative called Check the Box, which increased the font size of film ratings descriptions and produced a PSA that is played in movie theaters and online these were sort of very surface level measures, and parents were not, some parental organizations were not particularly happy with them, such as the Parents Television Council. You know, I think if movies are to curtail violence or the upwards creep in violence, that impetus is going to have to come from outside groups. At every step of the way, the ratings board has only changed when there has been the threat of sort of parents raising a ruckus or the government intervening. You know, in 1922, the Hays Code was implemented because several policymakers had introduced bills that might have censored the film industry. In 1968, the age-based system that we currently have was proposed because there had been two Supreme Court decisions that suggested that an aged and outside age-based rating system might be coming. And, you know, in 1984, when Steven Spielberg started the PG-13 rating, it was all because parents complained. So ultimately, it is going to be up to the parents to speak out if they feel that an increase in violence is not something they would like their children to be exposed to in popular entertainment anymore.
Katie Kilkenny, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Katie Kilkenny, associate editor who writes about culture for Pacific Standard. You can find a link to read her brief history of increasing violence in PG-13 films. It's at wordofmouthradio.org. Hollywood has had a long relationship with Morocco. Maybe it's the diversity of the country's cities or the spectacular desert light. But some people are not crazy about how the landscape and people are cast. Producer Jake Warga has the story.
Morocco has stood in for Arabia, for Lawrence, Abu Dhabi, for Sex and the City, Egypt, for Evil Mummies.
Morocco has been fantastic countries, like in Game of Thrones. It's been Syria for Syriana, Homeland, an Iraqi movie for American Sniper. My name is Nariman Fakir. I am French-Moroccan.
Nariman Fakir would know. She's been working on Moroccan film sets for over 5 years and was the local casting director for American Sniper. She admits Hollywood can be good for the economy.
Just remember when everybody else is shooting the same direction.
When you work on the Black Hawk Down, they had 12 cameras. It was a crew of 500 people. It helps in the way that technicians have work. They can feed their families.
But it bothers her that Morocco is rarely Morocco in the movies. More often, it's a stand-in for ravished war zones.
On 100 movies, maybe 3 movies represent Morocco.
Some Moroccan filmmakers worry that their country might be seen in a negative light.
A very pre-built point of view from the studio in the U.S. saying, okay, let's go to Morocco. Morocco, where is it? In North Africa. Oh, that's perfect. Pictures, Morocco, Google. Okay. Oh, sand desert. Okay, that's perfect. It's cheaper for us to shoot there than the Arizona desert. And it's safer to shoot there than real Iraq. So that's the best compromise.
That's Otman Nassiri, a Moroccan filmmaker. He's also not happy with the way locals are portrayed.
The Moroccan people are casted as typical Arab profile, terrorists, bad guys, according to the American point of view. You know, we are not so far from the Western point of view in the 50s. The good, the bad, and the ugly.
Saleh near Rabat became Somalia for Black Hawk Down, then Fallujah for American Sniper. Amal Idrisi, a law professor in Morocco, recognized some of the locations while watching American Sniper. It upsets her seeing her country as a war-torn location, that the film
made Morocco look like any other Middle Eastern country that is at war, while for me as a Moroccan, I can distinguish the doors, I can recognize the minarets, I can recognize the architecture and clearly see that that is not a Middle Eastern country at war.
Alors qu'on n'est pas en guerre.
Moroccan filmmakers are trying to fix this terrorist cliché by exporting their own image of the country and the people. Again, filmmaker Otman Nassiri.
Morocco now produce like 25 feature films per year, which is absolutely not bad.
It's not. Moroccan films have even recently made it to the Cannes Film Competition. In his next movie, filmmaker Otman Nassiri is taking up the delicate, often debated subject of Moroccan history.
I'm preparing my second feature film about women emancipation in Morocco during the 50s. And this is really important to look at our history.
It would be hard to end a story about films in Morocco without some mention of the classic 1942 film Casablanca, a film which really put Morocco on the cinema map, a film that was shot entirely on location in Burbank, California.
You must remember this.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Bouncing back from addiction requires support, companionship, and alternatives to old habits. Mike Reardon and Josh Chapman find all those in skateboarding and in each other. Together, they stay clean by creating skateboarding videos for Instagram. Producer Todd Whitney brings us their story.
Mike Reardon is battling with a kickflip to fakie. That's a skateboard trick he's nailed before, but right now, it's just not coming to him. Mike skates every day, and every day he wears a similar outfit. A fitted hat, a couple oversized t-shirts, a nasty cast that protects his broken wrist, and a cigarette that dangles from his lips when he's on his skateboard. Cigarettes are the only vice he has left. Mike's friend Josh is filming, and he's been waiting for 20 minutes for Mike to nail the trick so that he can edit the footage and then put it up on Instagram.
Got a fisheye lens. I use an Olo clip, costs it like $80. Clips onto my iPhone 6 just fine. I got the fisheye lens for it, so I can capture everything really easily where I don't have to necessarily be looking at the camera the whole time. It kind of soaks up the whole image.
Front crook or nose grind? Nose grind, I'll get it probably first try, but front crook.
Front crook, dude. Just get the front crook. Right. Be a boss. Be about it!
After the skate session, Mike and Josh cut out for a bite to eat. Josh depends on Mike and his 2001 Honda Civic for rides. He hasn't driven since he was pulled over by police after overdosing in a stolen car. Back when Mike was using his car to cop heroin, his homies called it the smack taxi. Now, it's their main place to kick it and crash whenever they hit hard times. So they call it the Batmobile. The car is a refuge for the skate squad. It's wild, disheveled, and littered with empty energy drink cans and expired cartons of L&M's.
The poor man's Marlboro Red.
The backseat is crammed with skateboard parts like decks and wheels and trucks and some clothes. Mike and Josh are up front.
The young kids, dude, what are you doing? Stay
away
from drugs, dude. I just want to smoke blunts and drink 40s and listen to Biggie Smalls and not give a f***. And I used to be like that. You know where I ended up, Josh? I ended up with a needle of crack in my neck. That's where I ended up.
Josh and Mike met about a year and a half ago at a 12-step meeting. Josh noticed Mike's SB Dunks, a sneaker staple for skaters. Right after they met, they hit the skate park on a Sunday for a night session. And they've been skating and filming since. Mike skates with a broken wrist that refuses to heal because he won't stop skating. The heroin addiction prevents him from taking painkillers when he bangs up his body, so he just keeps on skating right through the pain. Even though his body takes a beating, he needs to skate every day.
It takes me out of myself. The same way drugs do, the same way alcohol did. It's something that would bring me away from this overwhelming feeling of doom that always followed me my whole life. You know what I mean? Where everything's gonna fall apart.
Why do you choose to film Mikey in particular?
Mikey just looks like he's like a badger on a skateboard. It's just like that slimy style that's just awesome. That like nobody goes for. Everyone wants to like do everything super clean and what's the word I'm looking for? Trying to capture Mikey's personality more than his skating, I guess.
Would you say that Mikey is a muse for your work?
Mikey inspires me all the time.
Basically,
you know, like,
I don't think you know the meaning of the word muse, but all right.
Mikey, define muse.
Like, you're a ball of clay, dude. Like, what are you trying to do?
I'm looking up the definition of muse because now I'm doubting myself, dude.
In Greek and Roman mythology, each of the 9 goddesses, the daughters of Zeus and Mincine, I don't even know, who presided over the arts and sciences.
You're the god of the arts.
And you're my little artist. You're my daughter. Atta girl.
One more. Do it again.
When I get ideas, like I'll go to Mikey and I'll be like, I want you to do a big spin heel on the bank. And then like he'll do it with the pivot and it'll look dope. And I'm like, see, it looks ill.
For Josh and Mikey, The skating takes him away from the daily drag, and it's the friendship that keeps him grounded. And that combo is just what they've been looking for.
And that story was produced by Todd Whitney for WCAI's Creative Life series. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. For someone who never went to law school, Derek Hamilton has a pretty good record. He learned about the law while serving time for a murder that he didn't commit. Derek is well known among so-called jailhouse lawyers. He's filed federal complaints for inhumane treatment of inmates and helped others obtain hearings in addition to fighting his own conviction, which was vacated after 21 years on the inside. He continues to work with prisoners as a paralegal at the Novo Law Firm in Manhattan, and he manages the Novo Innocence Project. We read all about him in a profile called Home Free by the New Yorker reporter at large, Jennifer Gonerman. And Derek Hamilton, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you did have some run-ins with the police when you were younger and served some time for robbery as a teenager. But when did you start learning about the law?
Well, I started learning the law when I was actually a young kid accused of murder. And the system was treating me unfair. And a lawyer that I had by the name of Candace Kurtz kind of told me that I needed to educate myself to understand how I was being railroaded by the system. She gave me two cases. I read them. I was always good in school, so my reading comprehension was always one of my favorite subjects. And amazingly to me, I was able to understand them and have a conversation with this very intelligent lawyer about what was happening to me.
But you were arrested again in 1991, then charged with the murder of Nathaniel Cash. Now, we should mention the detective in this case, Louis Scarsella, who interrogated you. What role did he play in your conviction?
Well, Louis Scarsella was the individual who made a non-witness become a identifying witness, despite the fact that she never saw the murder, and in fact had told his partner, Detective DeLuigia and Scarsella, that she didn't see the crime. He told her that she would stay in jail. He took her to the precinct and said, "You won't get out. You would be charged with the murder if you don't say that you saw Derek commit this horrendous crime."
Mm.
So he was the person who actually had me identified.
He coerced the witness. You did have a solid alibi. This woman was Jewel Smith, Nathaniel Cash's girlfriend, who supposedly named you. But she changed her story a few times.
Under pressure, you do some of the darnest things. You know, we see that people confess every day to murders and crimes they didn't commit. So, I mean, you have a young lady who have two children who's on parole herself, and you got a cop saying, "Look, you're going to jail unless you say this." I know in her defense, I would say that most young women in her age and in her situation from my community would have did the same thing to get out of the precinct.
Mm. Well, you did write your own motion from Rikers Island asking the judge, Edward Rappaport, to set aside the verdict based on Jewel, this woman, telling this PI she had been threatened. Scarsella, of course, denied it, called her reliability into question, though she was actually the key witness in your conviction. What did the judge say?
Well, interestingly, the judge found, because the prosecution witness, Jewel Smith, was unreliable, that I should stay in jail. My issue was that Jewel Smith was always a prosecution witness. We never called her to court on any occasions. In fact, we called the detective to establish that Jules first told him she didn't see the crime. We never called her. So I was amazed how the judge could find that the prosecution witness was incredible, yet blame me and keep me in prison for 21 years based on that.
And meanwhile, you had a couple of witnesses signed affidavits that they knew where you were on the day in question. What happened to their testimony?
Well, originally at trial, my lawyer asked for a continuance in order to procure these witnesses to testify. The judge refused to give us a two-day continuance to secure the witnesses. Some of them were being threatened by a police officer in New Haven, Connecticut, by the name of Billy White, who ultimately was arrested himself for crimes in New Haven, Connecticut. And he was threatening these witnesses and telling them that had they come forth in New York to testify, that they themselves would be locked up, they themselves would be subjected to some reprisal. So, I mean, there was interference by government officials.
Was your own case your first case as a jailhouse lawyer?
Yes, my own case is definitely was always my first case. I was successful in previous litigations, and it gave me more confidence. And the more that I learned, working in the law library in the jails, you're going to always have a very many prisoners, 700 or 800 come into the law library within a year, if not more. And it's your job as a counterman to be able to learn the different variances of their situation and to be able to give them the best advice that you possibly can. So I just studied and studied and studied to try to learn as much as I possibly can to be able to help these guys.
I'm sorry, you say that you had success in your own case, but yet you were still in prison.
Right. You know, in prison, it's successful if you have a hearing.
Mm.
If you can get a judge to call you down and hear you. I mean, there's so many guys that put motions and never get a hearing. In my case, I had four. So, I mean, just to be able to get back before the judge and almost be able to walk out that door is more successful than the average guy ever get.
Mm. Now, it was at Attica. You ran into another inmate who said he was also set up by Scarsella and went to work to refute your conviction. How do you know where to begin? How did you know what to do?
You know, there was always older guys who tutored me. And one of the things that I learned, first and foremost, that you had to know the 4th, 5th, 6th, 8th, and 14th Amendment. And excuse me if I bore readers with this, but they said these amendments were the fundamentals of understanding the criminal justice system. So once I learned those, and then I began to read the procedures that must be present whenever a person go to trial, and you look at these procedures to see if any of these things was violated in your trial, and you learn these amendments to see if any of these rights was violated in your trial. So for me, that was the most fundamental place to begin.
Mm. Just having this knowledge, you started advising other prisoners. What kind of cases might you take on?
Well, mostly for me, it was murder cases or violent cases where guys didn't have the light of day, but there was always, you know, family court cases and different things of that nature. You know, before I was able to help anybody, I had to have some success of my own, and I did. And once you're having success in your case and other cases, you get an unlimited number of prisoners that always come in and asking for some assistance. So, I mean, I just took on any case where it was evident that there was a wrongful conviction or a guy was innocent.
Are inmates actually allowed to represent other inmates in court?
There was one guy that was able to do it. His name was Jerry Rosenberg, Jerry the Jew. He was way back when, I think he represented Carmine Gelente, and there's a saying that he got Carmine acquitted, and then the jury seen Jerry get put in handcuffs. I think he was the only one that was able to do it. In that particular case, he was the lawyer for, I think, Carmine Gelente.
What a sight that must have been.
Yes, yes.
Jerry the Jew is kind of legendary, I guess. Did you ever meet him?
Me and Jerry was in Windy Correctional Facility together, and we often conferred and often talked. In fact, I got an autograph copy of a book or something he gave me. When Jerry had real sick one time, and he had his heart had failed, and they took him out to the hospital and revived him. And he made an argument to the judge that they had to release him because he was on his second life, that he only had one life sentence, and he died on the operating table. It was the second life. And there was an article about that somewhere, and the judge said, very interesting, Jerry, but you stay in jail. And we used to make fun of stuff like that. So, good guy, though. Very good guy.
Great story. How were you treated by prisoners and the staff, given all of your grievances and your advocacy for other inmates?
Well, I mean, Attica Correctional Facility is famous for its brutal way they treat prisoners. I did 10 years there. And, you know, if it wasn't for me being a litigant and being able to write the Department of Justice, being able to write the Federal Bureau Investigator and say, hey, these guys are trying to kill me, and put them on notice that I notified people on the outside that this was happening, I probably wouldn't be here talking to you today. So, I mean, on one step, there is, you know, your fear that something terrible is going to happen because you see it happening to prisoners all around you who are not as educated or let's say, fearless as you in that regards to just say, you know what, if I'm going to die, I'm going to let the Federal Bureau Investigator know that, you know, this is what's happening. I'm going to let the Department of Justice know, and I'm going to let the superintendent know that I wrote the Department of Justice this morning and have my people contact them and let them know. But it's always fear. I mean, you see guys being beaten by our correction officers in Attica daily. I mean, you're afraid. You're constantly afraid, no matter how tough you are, that your number is going to play the next day.
We're talking with Derek Hamilton, who, like so many jailhouse lawyers, acquired his legal skills while incarcerated. He was wrongfully convicted and served 21 years for murder. That conviction was vacated, and he now works with other prisoners for the Novo Innocence Project out of the Novo law firm that's in Manhattan. I want to talk about the breakthrough in your case. What happened? What changed things for you, this case involving Troy Davis, if you can go through that for us?
Well, Troy Davis, in 2009, I would say, the United States Supreme Court ruled for the first time in American history that it was unconstitutional, or maybe unconstitutional, to send an innocent man to death row, to kill a man who, but there was evidence, but there was overwhelming evidence he may be innocent. And they remanded the case back down to the Georgia District Court to hold a hearing. To me, that was hope, because I was having the same problem in Kings County, in Brooklyn, that the court would not give me a hearing on an actual innocence claim, which would allow me to present all of my evidence, the alibis, eyewitnesses who saw the crime and identified the true killers. I mean, all of this evidence that was being thrown in the garbage, I would have an opportunity to have judged on its own probative value. And Troy Davis' case seemed to have indicate that I was entitled to that. And armed with that information, I made a motion, and I contacted a lawyer by the name of Jonathan Ellerstein, and I sent him a copy of the motion in the Troy Davis case and said, hey, I'd like to hire you. I don't have a lot of money. I think I might have sent him $1,500 on my commissary account, which he sent back. And he said, look, I can't take your money. You've made a perfect motion. You've argued everything that you're supposed to argue. He also said he was outraged at the fact that the court had threw all my evidence of innocence in the garbage and that I should go to the media with it.
Can I sum that up in my understanding of the language?
Sure.
That the sworn affidavits from the two witnesses were not accepted because they were not presented at the original trial. Did I get that right?
Right.
Okay,
right.
Do you think I have a career in law now?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You can definitely, you can definitely be a lawyer at this front.
So Edelstein suggested that you go to the media. What'd you do?
I organized my family. I asked them to go before the Supreme Court, Kings County, and protest. Have a picket, picket signs and go out there. And they did. And a reporter happened to be coming by from the Daily News of New York named Orrin Yanov, who said he would investigate. After several months of investigating, he wrote a story that says inmate will be free if they allow his witnesses to testify, some of that nature. It kind of changed the dynamics of everything, because I was going to the parole board at that time, and the parole board had a requirement that you admit to your guilt, that you show remorse in order to get out of prison. So when the article came out and I was arguing with the parole board, it kind of like put me in a position to be able to say, well, look, not only do I know that I was given a raw deal, but so does the Daily News, and so does the, Innocence Project, and so does these other people who wrote things on my behalf. The parole board ultimately released me in 2009, and I was able to get out to society and continue to fight my case.
By that time, 21 years served, your children were grown, you did have a new wife,
yes. A
new child. What was that like, being back out in the world after all that time?
Well, let me just go back a little bit. When I was in Auburn Correctional Facility, where I actually got parole from, I already had started a actual innocence team amongst Shabaka Shakur, Danny Rincon, Nelson Cruz, Richard Rosario. I mean, a few of these guys who had overwhelming evidence that they was innocent, and we got a team of guys together, and we said, hey, look, we got to get our families together to organize. We got to kind of like make some noise out in the city to let people know we exist, and that we exist in not just a vacuum. It's more of us than they believe who has been subjected to these type of, atrocities. So ultimately, when I left prison, I left with these guys left behind. I left with, Shabaka Shakur looking at me that morning when I'm walking out of the door, and both of us was convicted by Scarsella. We knew exactly what he did to each one of us. And he says, hey, man, don't forget me. So when I left with the voices of Shabaka, Richie, Danny, Nelson, in my ear. So I had to get out, and I had to continue what we already began from behind these walls, and I had to be the biggest advocate for the families of the wrong conviction, because if I didn't, then they would probably give up on their loved ones.
By the time you got out, Louis Scarsello had long been retired. Shabaka Shakur was set up by him. Another, Alvina Jeanette, also set up by him.
Yes.
The New York Times actually ran a story citing your case, going through his long history of alleged misconduct, falsifying confessions, coercing witnesses, in several murder cases. The DA said they would review every homicide case that he'd ever worked on. So has there ever been a case against him?
No, well, there haven't been a case against him. Actually, we learned recently that there's an investigation by the New York City Police Department against him, but there hasn't been any, you know, findings that we know of. He hasn't been prosecuted. We believe the statute of limitations is long since ran. We hope that he continues to be Scott Sella in federal depositions, as he's done in all the other trials he went through, and he lies, and he gets convicted in federal court for perjury, is my hope. But he's still living on his pension. He's still living high, and he's still denying that he did anything wrong. And 9 people so far has been convictions, murder convictions, have been reversed. It has been proven that non-witnesses, people who were in jail, he used to say that they saw somebody commit a crime. Teresa Gomez, he used in 6 different murder cases. So, I mean, it's just case after case that shows that he violated rights, and nothing has happened to this man. Nothing. Nothing at all.
Well, how about on your part, a civil lawsuit, a wrongful conviction suit?
We definitely have civil lawsuits filed against him. But, you know, when you're indemnified by the state and the city, when they protect you from having to pay, or we can't go after his pension, it doesn't really bother him that much. It just bothers the city and taxpayers, city and state taxpayers. But, I mean, the laws should be changed when cops like him will be held liable.
Well, so you are continuing to work with people wrongfully convicted or people who, you know, their rights were violated or they didn't get adequate representation. But I'm wondering, Derek Hamilton, why, you know, after you've met so many people who said that they've been screwed over by the criminal justice system, they've been screwed over by the police, you still believe in the power of the law.
Well, you know, I'll tell you that I believe in the power of people. You know, I believe the law in itself is interpreted by people to mean a variety of different things. And you know, you get one bad judge, doesn't mean you should give up. It doesn't mean that you say the system is messed up. That judge is messed up. That, you know, I mean, I believe in holding people accountable. You know, I believe in you educate people to understand that there's no perfect system of justice. But as people, we can improve it. And if we don't do it, then who are? And I believe if we're not a part of the solution, we're part of the problem. So for me, being a voice of the voiceless, being able to, you know, sit in a courtroom sometime and you know, have a wrongful conviction T-shirt or hat and watch a judge and shake my head when he do something wrong and to maybe call and says, you know, hey, I'm a reporter and what you did today was wrong, just to let them know someone cared. You know, I think that if we all did that, we would change the system.
Derek Hamilton, thank you very much for speaking with us.
You're welcome, and thanks for having me.
Derek Hamilton, now a free man after serving 21 years for a murder that he did not commit. He now manages the Novo Innocence Project. That's out of the Novo Law Firm in Manhattan. There's a link to read the profile of him and a follow-up by Jennifer Gonerman from The New Yorker at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. Music in this episode came to us from Dan Seste, Blue Dot Session, Broke for Free, and Poddington Bear. As always, much more to explore at wordofmouthradio.org, on our Facebook page, and on Twitter. I'm Virginia Prescott, back tomorrow at 2 with more Word of Mouth here on NHPR.